the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Be seated. There's one cause on the court's oral submission docket this morning. It is the Republican Party of Texas and Others versus the Honorable John K. Deet, an original mandamus proceeding. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral arguments. The relators may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. The court is ready to hear argument from relators.
May it please the court, Mr. Charles Bunger will present arguments for relators. The ladies have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Charles Bunger, counsel for the Republican Party, Tom Hawkins, and Barbara Jackson. I will refer to them as simply the party or the Republican Party for ease of convenience. The plaintiffs below and the real parties in interest here are Law Cabinet Republicans and Mr. Dale Carpenter. I'll simply refer to them as the Law Cabinet Republicans. I believe the court wished to hear argument with respect to the court's jurisdiction to issue this original mandamus proceeding, and I wish to address first the jurisdictional question. The Texas Government Code, Section 22.002, as well as 273.061 of the Election Code, gives this court jurisdiction to issue this original mandamus proceeding. In this court's decision in LaRouche, which was a prior original mandamus proceeding before this court, argued by my able opposing counsel, in this case, Mr. Wiseman, the court issued a mandamus in that particular matter that was an original mandamus proceeding. That dealt with the placement of the candidate's name on the ballot for the primary election. And the court granted the mandamus relief because of the impending event, which was the election, and because of the urgency of the matters before the court.
Didn't you could just bypass court appeals?
Not in every case, Your Honor. The standard that was established in both the Sears case and in the LaRouche case is whether or not we have a matter that is impending and whether or not it's of statewide importance. And I believe that we have a Republican convention that's going to start tomorrow, where all Republicans are coming together who have been elected from the county and precinct conventions. They will gather in San Antonio tomorrow. This matter will be over with by Saturday.
What about the requirement for an appeal for a temporary injunction order to the Court of Appeals?
We would not have, Your Honor, time to get an ordinary expedited appeal to the Court of Appeals. And in both the LaRouche case and the Sears case, and under the Election Code, this court does have jurisdiction because of the urgency of the matter and because of the statewide implications.
Well, what about Log Cabin's argument that this will be a continuing possible controversy at succeeding conventions and so forth, so it's not moot?
Your Honor, I can only address the temporary injunction order, and the temporary injunction order of the district court is specifically addressed to this convention, not to future matters. And therefore, I believe that that order, which is the order before this court, will be moved by Saturday when the convention is over. And therefore, it is urgent that this court act.
Why did you not have time to speak?
The normal appeal process, Your Honor, would have required us to go through the briefing schedule that's set forth in the appellate rules. While we could get an expedited appeal, that briefing schedule would have had 20 days in which the respondent would have had to respond to our briefing schedule. And because of the urgency of this matter and the need to get this matter to a court who can look at this matter, we felt that the urgency and the statewide implications under LaRouche and Sears gives this court jurisdiction. In the Election Code, in the brief that I received last night from Mr. Wiseman, the Law Cabinet Republicans, he cited a section of the Election Code which deals with 273.63 and argued in that particular brief that that denied this court jurisdiction. I would point out to the court that that section deals with venue and not jurisdiction. It deals with venue in the Court of Appeals and not jurisdiction. Section 273.061, which I've referenced before, is the provision of the Election Code which gives this court the jurisdiction to deal with matters involving political party conventions, and it's very specific, as well as the Government Code itself. We would argue under LaRouche and under Sears, which are both decisions of this court, that there is an urgency, there is a need for the court to act, and that this is of statewide implication. The ability of a district court judge To affect what occurs at a political party's state convention is a matter of great importance to this state and the precedent that that will establish. This court has not hesitated to act in other situations involving these types of matters, such as LaRouche and Sears. The Log Cabin Republicans also argue under this court's decision in Iranian Muslim case, which was the protest case, that the court should not become involved in the mandamus. I would submit to the court that that was a prior restraint on the freedom of speech case, and that it was capable of repetition, but it was evading review. Again, in answer to your justice's question, we are arguing about the order that was entered by the district court, which will have effect beginning tomorrow, and will end on Saturday when the convention is over. We are not arguing about the broader merits of the case, but the effect of that order is to compel Barbara Jackson and Tom Parkin and the Republican Party to do an act which the law does not require them to do. And
how far does the order go? Mr. Carpenter is a delegate to the convention?
He is, Your Honor.
He will be president of the convention?
He will, Your Honor.
He can pass out leaflets at the convention?
He can, on his personal basis, he can, provided that the other delegates are provided. I'm not sure about the rules with respect to his right. He will also have a right to appear before the platform committee.
Well, let's talk about the right to hand out leaflets. There's some indication in the brochures and the advertisements that the only way you can make a written communication with the other delegates is either by purchasing a booth and handing out literature there or by buying space in the program. Is that not literally enforced?
I believe, Your Honor, that is correct. I believe that, in other words, in order to have the right as an organization, which is what the Log Cabin Republicans are, as an organization for the Log Cabin Republicans to have a right to distribute information, they can do it through the advertisement in the program or the booth.
But an individual can hand out anything he or she wants to on the floor of the convention?
Your Honor, it's my understanding under the rules that if you are a delegate or if you are a candidate for office, that you have a right to distribute materials in your individual capacity, but not in the capacity of some organization that otherwise has no legal right to be there. The Log Cabin Republicans are not a delegate, and they don't have a legal right to be at the convention. They were not elected at their precinct or county areas. Mr. Carpenter is a delegate. He does have a right to be there. He does have a right to appear before the platform committee.
He has the right to speak to anybody he wants to speak about any issue.
As he wanders around, he does, Your Honor. Absolutely.
But your position is that the Log Cabin Republicans cannot communicate inside the convention with others unless they have a booth.
As an organization, they cannot, Your Honor, because they do not have a right otherwise under the election code or under the law to appear. And this was an order that was entered on behalf of the Log Cabin Republicans. And the application that we received was from the Log Cabin Republicans, not from Mr. Carpenter.
Can Mr. Carpenter identify himself as president of the Log Cabin Republicans and speaking to others? Is there any prohibition or anything to prevent him from doing that?
I know of no rule that would prevent him from walking up to another delegate, introducing himself, and say, I'm Bill Carpenter, I'm president of the Log Cabin Republicans. And in fact, he can invite them to come to his reception. The Log Cabin Republicans are having a reception, not at the convention, but at a hotel, a private reception. He has the right to invite people to come. There's nothing in the rules that I know of that would prevent him from doing that. This is limited solely to the right of the Log Cabin Republicans to have a booth and to have an advertisement in the program and nothing more. Not to the right of a delegate who is there legally to be able to walk and to talk and to visit and
hand
out.
Could he hand out a copy of the ad that has been rejected?
In his individual capacity, I know of no reason that he cannot. That issue has not been addressed by the district court below, and the order does not go to that issue. It goes only to the issue of the booth and the advertisement.
So you take the position that Judge Dietz's order does not impinge his ability to participate in the political process in any way?
Not in any way with respect to his right to appear before the platform, to discuss issues, to talk with other delegates while he's there. He has a legal right to be there because he was elected at his precinct convention and then again, I think, at the county convention. So he has a right to be there. And in the statement of facts before the court, it was made clear by Barbara Jackson, the executive director, that Mr. Carpenter would have a clear right to participate as a delegate in the convention.
Is it your position that Log Cabin Republicans have been denied a booth and an ad because of the content of their message?
because of the content of the message, Your Honor, and because the executive director found that to be objectionable, the rule that was adopted by the Republican Party permits the party to reject a booth or to reject an ad based upon the content, on the objectionable nature of the content, and the rule actually says for any other reason.
Could they exclude the group because of Mr. Carpenter's race?
Your Honor, that would go into the issue of equal protection under the federal Constitution, which is not before the court, and I don't know that they could do that.
We protect race under the state Constitution also.
I don't know that they could, Your Honor, if it was because of the race.
What's the difference?
Well, I think that there are certain other rules that apply with respect to equal protection rights when you have a protected class. Race is a protected class. Ideology is not a protected class. The right of people to advocate a particular political position is not protected under equal protection.
So you're saying there is, the Republican Party is acting as the state to some extent in deciding who to give a vote to and who not to give a vote to?
I don't believe that they are, Your Honor, and that gets to the core question on the merits of this, and that is whether or not the Constitution applies as the Republican Party being a state actor. If the Republican Party is found by this court, or either Democratic, Republican or Democratic Party, any of the political parties are found by this court to be state actors, then certainly the Constitution applies.
Well, of course, the Texas Constitution is still an open question as to whether and to what extent it may apply to non-state actors.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Pseudo-state actors.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But is it your position, I gather in response to Justice Heck's question, it's your position that the Republican Party could take some acts with regard to the booth and the program that would implicate the free speech concern, the free speech protections of the state constitution?
I believe that they can. I believe their rules that they've adopted allow them to do so, and I believe that they can.
My question was, could they take some acts that would run afoul of our state constitution?
I believe that they can, Your Honor, because they are not a state actor, and they are not controlled.
I'm not asking my question.
I'm sorry.
Could the Republican Party do something to some group that would give that group a right to seek legal relief because of a violation of the state constitution?
Not unless the Republican Party or any political party is found to be a state actor such that those particular guarantees are applicable to that particular party.
Is that because you're saying that the Texas Constitution only protects speech rights against infringement by the state?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So you just admitted a minute ago that's an open question, but you think we ought to close?
That is my position. I don't think that the court has closed that position. The Jones decision out of Houston, the A versus Weaver decision from the Austin Court of Appeals, two leading cases on that, this court has never addressed that question. Up to what extent does the Constitution of the state of Texas apply to purely private parties?
So just looking at state action, you would say the Republican Party of Texas is not a state actor with regard to these booths?
That's correct, Your Honor.
It would clearly be with regard to some other things.
It would be with regard to other things, such as the holding of a primary election.
All right,
I think they are on that issue.
So if it's not a state actor, you could preclude, for instance, black Republicans of Texas from having a booth simply because of their race?
I think that we could if we chose to. However, I do distinguish between suspect classifications, which race is, and ideology classifications, which this particular issue is not.
So you are not excluding log-cabin Republicans because of the sexual orientation of
their
members?
No, because of the message and the content and the objectionable nature of the content that they've proposed.
If this same group had another message about what they thought the Republican Party's platform ought to be with regard to the sodomy laws, then you might or would let them have a booth and advertise.
That would be up to the discretion of the executive director.
But their sexual orientation was not part of the judgment.
It was not it was the message and the content of the message that Ms. Jackson testified that she made her decision on. And the question is does she have the right under our application and under our rules and policies to make those types of discretionary decisions? We have in our...
What was it about the content that was found objectionable? Wasn't it based on sexual orientation?
It was based upon the statements that were made by the Log Cabin Republicans and what they proposed to put into the program and what they proposed to distribute at the booth, including some video material and including some publications.
What was the evidence about what the party thought was objectionable? What was objectionable about the content?
The statements that were made by them concerning the laws, concerning the family, concerning issues, concerning what sons, daughters, children, those types of things were found by the executive director to be objectionable and to be contrary to what the Republican Party wanted to project as an image at its convention. And the question is, does she have a right to exercise her discretion under the documents that Mr. Carpenter signed, which clearly give her the right to reject it for any reason?
Mr. Benner?
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt, but this seems to me that one of the unique aspects of this case is not whether or not the Republican Party sponsors a message that it doesn't agree with. It seems to me the issue here is whether or not the Republican Party can exclude from the premises, the convention premises, people who wish to express a message to the Republican Party that the party executive director doesn't agree with. Is there any distinction in this issue here? I mean, this is not a St. Patrick's Day parade where the sponsor of the parade, that's a public event, don't want someone participating in the parade that conveys a message that they don't want to convey. This is a situation where this isn't a parade. This isn't a public event. This is a Republican Party convention. The delegates come to the convention, and within the walls of this convention, the Republican Party says, we don't want to receive this message.
That is correct, John.
Is there any distinction or in terms of constitutional parameters of our discussion that makes a difference here?
There is, Your Honor, and that is the forum. I think Your Honor is addressing the forum. This is not a public street. This is not a public forum. This is a private association of people for political purposes. This court in Carter versus Tomlinson and in Bell versus Hill, two very old decisions, adopted the rule that the political parties are not state actors and that we are not a state and public association. We are a private association of people. The Republican Party is.
But we know that's not right in terms of deciding who your nominee is going to be. All the people will vote on at the general election.
With respect to
the court has told us that.
With respect to elections, that's correct, Your Honor.
Now, and on the other hand, it seems to be that in terms of who you choose to be your party leader or the composition of your executive committee, who's on that, that's a purely party matter and one that the courts are very loath to get into. But where in that spectrum does your platform fall?
The platform is the statement or the position of the party with respect to the issues, the political issues, that the party and the congregation of the delegates wish to vote on.
If there's some obligation of the elected officials to respect that platform and try to enact it, doesn't that make that closer to the primary nominees than it does to the party chair?
I don't think that the courts have jurisdiction to get involved in addressing a political party's platform, that is not a justiciable issue that the courts must stay away from trying to get involved in determining what the platform of the political party is going to be, which is what the district court here is attempting to do. Although I would make a distinction here, Your Honor, in that Mr. Carpenter does have a right to appear before the platform committee. We're only addressing the booth and the advertisement. And the party has a right, as Justice Enoch indicated, to decide the content of the messages that will be disseminated at their private convention.
So what you're saying is that the government cannot dictate to a political party what their platform can or cannot include.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
One other question concerning state action. Are you saying that because, with regard to this particular activity, the Republican Party of Texas is not a state actor, that we do not have to balance the constitutional rights of the Republican Party of Texas with the constitutional free speech rights of the Log Cabin Republicans?
That's correct, Your Honor, because the Republican Party of Texas, as to this issue, is not a state actor. Therefore, we never reached the constitutional question in Article 1, Section 8.
You do concede that the Republican Party of Texas is a state actor for some purposes.
Correct,
but you say it is not for this purpose.
That's correct.
And could you articulate for us a defining principle that we might apply, that you are applying?
I will certainly try, Your Honor. With respect to the primary elections, the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, the parties who hold primary elections are carrying out a traditional governmental function, that is, holding an election. With respect to the gathering of delegates at a convention, so that the parties, the people who have been there, can decide their platform and decide the issues for the campaign, that is not a traditional governmental function. That is a private function, which is guaranteed to them under Article 1, Section 27 of our Constitution, the right of people to assemble.
Would it be different if they were choosing the party's nominees at the convention by caucus?
If there had not been primary elections and if that was going to be a caucus, I think that probably would be different. That might be a considered to be a governmental function, but no governmental functions are going to occur in San Antonio at the Alamo Dome. And no public money is being used to support that. In our election scheme under our statutes, the parties are reimbursed or paid for or actually receive candidates' filing fees in order to carry out the elections. And so there's a financial relationship on the primary elections. That doesn't occur at the convention. It's solely private money. And no public money is being used, and no public officials are running it. It is solely the private party and none other. For these reasons.
I have a question. Would you briefly address the breach of contract issue?
I may, Your Honor. The contract issue, and I would refer to Exhibits 3, 5, 5, 2, and 9 that were offered by the plaintiff and admitted without objection at the TIFRA injunction hearing. Those exhibits set forth the rules of the Republican Party, and the rules of the Republican Party give the party and the exhibit's chairman the right to reject the booth. With respect to the booth,
after the money has, after they've accepted the check and cashed it?
It does, Your Honor, at any time. They have a right at any time, for any reason, to object to a booth. They reserve that right in the contract. And with respect to the advertisement, it clearly states that all ads are subject to approval by the Officials Committee of the Republican Party of Texas, and Mr. Carpenter, in his letter, states, if for some reason the ad is not accepted, please return the check, which we did. So there was never even an acceptance of the check with respect to the advertisement, and the check was returned. And in both instances, the party reserved the right to reject the booth and to reject the ad. So with respect to the contract, there simply is no basis, providing that we have a right to do that under the contract, which I believe the district court found we did not. Under his analysis, we were state actors and could not reject it. So with respect to the contract issue, we feel there is no basis. For these reasons, we would request that this court allow the petition to be filed and that the court issue a writ of mandamus to the district court dissolving the prior order against the Republican Party and its executive committee.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Patrick Wiseman will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Wiseman, what is the basis for your argument you were entitled to an injunction on the advertisement?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
What is the basis of your argument that you were entitled to an injunction on the advertisement issue?
Your Honor, that essentially is a contract issue. There was an offer. We accepted it. We were told by the party official who was assigned that duty that it had been accepted and that resolved
the claim. Okay testimony that Mr. Carpenter alluded to?
Yes, sir.
That who Mr. Hurley wasn't, said, well, the ad looks okay.
Well, I don't think that is a fair characterization.
Well, I read the record, and I know what it says.
And it's my characterization.
So your basis is contract. Is that it?
Right.
Is there any other ground to assert that you're entitled to an injunction on the advertisement?
Well, absolutely. And I think what Judge Deeds found was that we were entitled to it on a free speech basis. I think it's important to remember the the party has cited various provisions of the election code, 273.061, as authority for mandamus in this action. That and any other provision in the election code related to mandamus compel the performance of a duty imposed by law in connection with the holding of an election. So there is no basis for mandamus under that provision against Judge Dietz, who has no duties that are compelled by law related to the election.
Doesn't that section go on and say something about party conventions?
For the political party convention. But my point is not that. It is that Judge Dietz has no authority by law to deal with party elections. His job is a judge, just as yours is, and it's not a partisan election process that the election code grants authority for under the mandamus provisions.
Mr. Wiseman, do you agree that the U.S. Supreme Court has created a dichotomy in functions with a political party such that it, when it performs a function of the state, it can be considered sort of a state action, but when it's not performing the function of the state, it's not? I mean, don't you agree the Republican Party in Texas can be, in some instances, a state actor, in some instances, not a state actor?
I think that that would be true of even a public official.
Is the Republicans' rental of the Alamo Dome in San Antonio a state action, or is that a private action?
I think that is one of the reasons that mandamus is not appropriate in this case, because it does take that intimate sifting of the facts that even the petitioners acknowledge, or even the relators acknowledge in their brief, to sort out exactly what is and what is not state action.
If certain facts are alleged to violate one's constitutional rights, isn't that ultimately a question of law rather than a factual sifting, as you put it?
If it is, that is not what the courts in Texas have said up till now, and you would have to overrule a law.
Well, we've said that you don't defer to the trial court's findings of fact in a given case to determine whether the activities that are challenged constitute a constitutional violation.
Remember, this is a temporary injunction. So Judge Dietz's duty is only to determine, not whether we will prevail, not whether we will ultimately come out of this case as the winners. His is there a probable right? That is there a legitimate controversy?
But in making that ruling, didn't he trample on the First Amendment rights of the Republican Party of Texas?
Absolutely not. And we cite that very carefully.
Doesn't the Republican Party of Texas have freedom of association?
The Republican Party of Texas has its membership designated by the state. To be affiliated with the party, you don't go to any party rule. You go to the election code, which specifically sets out who can be a party member. And the party has no, some private club. I mean, one of the key ingredients to some small private club would be that you could designate your own membership. That is not the standard for the Republican Party, or the Democratic Party, or any other party.
In that regard, how do you distinguish the U versus San Francisco County Democratic Central Committee case out of the U.S. Supreme Court, the Tashjian versus Republican Party case out of the U.S. Supreme Court, the Democratic Party versus Wisconsin case out of the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Cousins versus Bogota case out of the U.S. Supreme Court?
In every one of those cases, in that state, the party had the opportunity to select its own membership. The party here has taken all the benefits of the election code, which the two major parties have lobbied it, gotten it to where they are comfortable with it. They essentially have accepted that arrangement, that the state creates their membership, the state creates their structure, the executive committee process is set up that way. Their rules are enforceable as law.
So what you're saying then is that nothing that a political party in the state of Texas does, or put it this way, everything that a political party does in the state of Texas is state action?
I don't think even everything this court does is state action.
I'm not talking about this court. I'm not talking about this court. I'm talking about, under your analysis, everything that a political party in the state of Texas does is state action.
No.
That a political party does is not state action?
Any number of things.
Such as?
As an example, I think that the party has the right to come up with a platform.
Why would that not be state action, since the whole framework of the party is set in place, you say, by state action? Why can you carve out little individual things that they do that's not state action? And if you can, why would the process of deciding what happens at a convention not be removed from state action?
Let me answer that two ways. And first is, the problem with a mandamus proceedings like this is that we have 20 minutes off of a one-day record and a temporary injunction. And so it's very hard to go back to the record and show you places that would work out. But secondly, when you sort through what a party does or doesn't do, you look at what it has in the way of state action requirements and what it doesn't. In this particular case, this is a particular case, this is not something in the abstract. The party is required by law to adopt rules.
So every time the legislature legislates about some activity of a voluntary association of individuals, does that imbue it with state action, regardless of the desires of the...
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, but I do know this, that when the party then turns around and adopts the Texas Constitution, including the First Amendment, or the Free Speech Clause, the Equal Protection Clause, and the Due Process Clause, that fact situation, which is what we're facing here.
Now, what does that mean? Now, do they have the power to say, no, we're not going to be guided by the state constitution or the state statutes? What does that mean?
It means this, Your Honor. They are bound to adopt rules. They're legally...
But they're bound by the constitution statutes whether they say so on the platform or document or not.
And I agree. And I would be happy to argue that in another case where we did not have such a strong particular issue here. But in this case, the party's bound to write rules. It writes a rule that says we adopt the Constitution.
Does that lead you to a conclusion because they adopt it that their action violates it? Isn't there a little gap in that reasoning? Don't you have to make an assessment of what happened and does it violate the Constitution?
And doesn't it matter whether or not they adopt it? They're still bound by the Constitution regardless of whether or not they express it.
I think he's entitled to answer the question. I'm holding my body with additional questions.
It makes a difference about the adoption because once adopted, that rule is enforceable as state law. That's the election code says that. And that's one of the reasons they're required to publish it with the Secretary of State's office. Once they have published that rule, yes, a court can get in and sit back and forth at whether they had a compelling interest or whatever the right standard may be as to whether or not they overcame the rights of...
Well, but as Judge Abbott pointed out earlier, the courts have ruled on these issues of state action, no state action. In particular, under the First Amendment, which is the argument by the Republican Party, that your situation involves a violation of their rights for associational purposes.
I heard Mr. Bundren agree that the law in Texas is not clear on how far beyond the traditional state action requirements we have in federal court extend in Texas.
Can we hone in on that point a moment? You conceded a moment ago that the party has the right to come up with its own platform, and I assume you were saying that when it does that, that's not a state action. It's not a state actor in that process. Is that correct?
As it has the right to come up with its own candidate.
And what I'm trying to find out, where do you draw the line between the process of coming up with a platform and determining who is entitled at the convention to speak to and attempt to influence delegates? Where do you draw the line? You say that is state action, apparently. Where between those two points? Do you draw the line? What's state action and what's not? And where do you draw it and why?
I draw the line at what political parties do. And what the courts have traditionally said is, we will make sure in the process, not in the result, but in the process, everybody gets a fair shot at their vote or their point of view or whatever it may be. Then we allow the vote. Nobody says that because the Republican Party is a state actor for purposes of creating a fair election process, nobody says, therefore, they cannot take a position on who should be the candidates. That is, the process that the party fulfills that is a state function is the process of assuring fairness to reach an outcome which can be partisan.
Well, if you say everyone's entitled to a fair shot, does that mean that the Republican Party has to take all comers and that if someone has a position to espouse, they're required to allow that message to be conveyed at the convention? Where can they draw the line?
I don't know the answer to that. What I do know is in the facts of this case, they have drawn the line simply around log cabin Republicans. They let the Texas Abortion and Reproductive Rights Organization have a vote, even though that's contrary to the policy and the platform of the party. They let companies that sell buttons
or t-shirts.
But the
issue is, could they have excluded who they chose to? When is it can they exclude and when is it can they not? You keep saying they have to take all comers, and I'm trying to get you to explain for us, when is it that they can draw the line and say, no, you don't have the right to address our delegates?
Courts traditionally, in free speech areas, don't say what an actor can do. What they say is what they can't do. And they don't try to create an advisory opinion of how they could do it better in the future. But what I think is that we would have, I think this is a very strong case, I think we would have a much weaker case if we were in fact in a situation where the party had adopted rules that fairly and equitably set out who could have a vote or who could print a program or whether the program could only be, the ad could only be related to commercial or something like that. Those kinds of rules which create a situation where there's not this unfettered discretion in one person just to willy-nilly decide that this group gets in, that group gets out.
Why don't they have that right as a private entity?
Well, if you ask me why don't they have the right as a private entity, and I answer it as if they are a private entity, then I have to agree with you they have the right.
So the private entities have it. Goes back to state action.
This is clearly a case.
You still haven't answered Judge Owen's question. Because if you continually go back to state action, her question is a fair comment on where you draw the line. You never said that yet.
I draw the line for this case. I draw the line here.
Well, I understand that. We understand that very clearly.
I meant to, after here, to have some words. In this case, I draw the line on the idea that the Republican Party took all the benefits of telling the citizens of the state of Texas that it complied with the statutes and the Constitution of the state of Texas. We went out and told people, this is what we stand for. We made it Rule 4. Rule 4 is enforceable as if a law.
But they also have a provision in the contract that said that we, subject to further review, we have the power to yank your ad or to return your money.
Any corporation, just simple contracts law is the agent cannot override the will of the principal. In this case, the principal is the party. The party adopted the rules. Obviously, the agents can't write a contract that violate their own rules, particularly when the rules here are not just like bylaws in a corporation. These are laws. These are the laws of the state of Texas.
So could the party have denied a booth to the Ku Klux Klan?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I don't think they could do it with the rules as they have them now.
Could they deny it to the Democratic Party?
I don't know the answer to that, but I don't think they could do it with the rules they have now.
They could not deny a booth to the Republicans for Clinton?
Your Honor,
is there such a group?
Let's deal with this.
Assuming there was, by your argument saying they cannot even deny it, if such a group existed, a booth to such a group.
Not now. Now, they may be able to sit down and write a set of rules that would allow them to do that. And that would be a different case.
So your argument is that there are internal rules that bring this about, not the Constitution and laws of the United States of Texas.
Their internal rules are law. I mean, that we cannot forget that. This is not a private organization creating private rules. If so, then the legislature could not write the election code. Because the election code is much more invasive as to associational freedom rights than anything that the respondents in this case are seeking to do. So that it is really not an issue of either or how we get there under the facts of this case, where the law says they must comply, the state law says they must comply with the Constitution and laws of the state of Texas insofar as they are applicable, and the party turns around and adopts Rule 4, which says we adopt the Constitution and laws of the state of Texas. Obviously, no agent could come along and write a contract that not only would violate what would be the bylaws of a corporation, but in fact are the laws of the state.
But counsel, there's something that just doesn't make sense about that, because it really doesn't matter whether or not they specifically adopt the laws and constitutions of Texas and the United States, because they're governed by them regardless of whether or not they adopt them.
Well, if they're governed by the law, then that is a much stronger case for us. That is, if they are governed by the free speech provisions of the Texas Constitution, then they've got to live up to them, and we don't have to go through that route. But what I'm saying here is, we don't have to get down to that harder case. We are in the remarkable position of having a perfectly logical syllogism of how this case works, which is, state law says you got to write rules. They write a rule, and state law says that rule is enforceable as law. Now, in some other circumstances, in some other case, maybe it's a harder issue.
Well, you agree with the conclusion that if the Republican Party of Texas is not a state actor, then the law cabinet Republicans' free speech rights have not been violated?
I would agree with that. One of the things that is particularly frightening to me is that decision, which is a complex decision in an evolving area of state law, would be made on an original mandamus proceedings in the Texas Supreme Court on this limited record.
What else are you going to put on in evidence when you have the merits?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What else are you going to put in the record when you have the trial on the merits?
Well, we haven't done discovery yet, so it's a little hard to say. But one of the things that the defendants in
who are you going to discover? You have Mr. Jackson as an adverse witness.
Yes,
sir. You have Mr. Carpenter as your witness. And she said she was the one who made the decision.
Your Honor, you've tried more cases than I have, and there's no doubt in my mind that...
Well, I'm more often than not on the temporary injunction here, you shoot to full boat, and there's nothing left to talk about on the merits.
And I'd like to talk about that a minute. We make a point of that in our brief. This issue arises on April 4th. Either on that day or in the next couple of days, the party knew it was going to reject the accepted offer on the book. They don't tell anybody until sometime after May 21st. They give us their final answer on May 28th. The lawsuit is filed on the 1st. The temporary injunction hearing is held on the 14th. And the argument that the state party is entitled to mandamus is they don't have time to comply with the rules. Now, they clearly could have gone under Rule 43 of the Appellate Rules of Procedure and asked for a stay. Or under Section B of that rule, they could have asked for a supersedeas with the district court. They chose to do neither one of those. They wanted a forum shop. They were getting here by claiming mandamus as a way of avoiding the third court.
You don't think this is an issue of statewide importance?
Whether the party admits in the record that there are plenty of booths, and it's going to be an insert to the program, and that's all this injunction does.
But in terms of the rights of the party, would you respond to the question whether or not this issue is of statewide importance or not?
My answer is no. It's clear.
It is.
That what we have here is a one vote.
Well, you don't think that if we were to agree with you, that you don't think there are other the other major political party would be interested in the precedential value of this decision in terms of who they could admit or deny admission to at their convention?
I think it would be a terrible mistake for this court to agree with me, because the court would have to use its mandamus power to do that. And this is not a proper case for mandamus. This is the precise kind of case. This is an issue that is not, on the one hand, novel in the Court of Appeal, nor is it decided. And the whole process of having a District Court or Court of Appeals in the Supreme Court is to allow many minds to focus on these issues, to crystallize the hard parts, to figure out how it all fits together, and then for this court to come up with a rational, considered opinion on what the ultimate law ought to be.
But even if there had been an appeal,
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Even if there had been an appeal, there's still only a few days between the district court's judgment and when it becomes moot.
And that's exactly what the party is trying to do in this case. It's trying to use mandamus as a substitute for an application for stay. Rule 43 allows them to ask for stay. And if it is, if you are...
But a stay decides the merits. A stay passed that.
It does not. And that's clearly what Iranian a Muslim organization holds. You would have to reverse that case, Texas Supreme Court case, to find that this case is in any way mooted after the convention. It's certainly not moot to us, because, of course, to get in for one convention does not solve my client's problem.
Well, if we take your argument to its logical conclusion, then we should issue a stay so you can do the merits in December, and we'll have the issues very concisely and considered over a long period of time.
If you wish to create a situation where the use of raw power is told the lawyers of the state, it's appropriate. The Court of Appeals is the court invested.
That's what I mean. We issue a stay and then wait until you try the merits and we do the whole thing at once. On your basis that it's not a moot question.
If that were the right way to go, then the party should have followed the clear outline of the ruling. But if the party wants to jump up here because it thinks it'll get a better forum, that truly starts to undercut the whole basis of judicial review.
Well, but we don't know that that's a correct supposition, because the Austin Court of Appeals hasn't ruled on anything.
Haven't been asking.
I understand that.
And it is a fairly standard process in our litigation that you go to the next court up. The rules provide...
Do you disagree that they are, you say they have no absolute right or any right at all to jump the Court of Appeals and come here?
This is not a mandamus. This is not a...
No, that's a different question.
I'm sorry, I always have these long answers that don't get right.
Well, if you answer the question directly, it should be
no,
short.
No, this is a temporary injunction proceedings. Rule 43 specifies what you do in relationship to a temporary injunction. You appeal it to the Court of Appeals. You ask for a stay. If the Court of Appeals had turned that down and they wanted to bring an emergency application to you, that would be in your discretion, I suppose, to consider. But that's not what they did. They forum shopped this case.
Is that, you know, forum shopping? Let's look at that for a moment. Is that so unique? Isn't that the way the game is played, unfortunately, by creative lawyers? Every day?
Mr. Bunner is a creative lawyer, a good lawyer. There is nothing unethical about what he did.
But my question is, isn't that the way the game is played every day by lawyers everywhere in the state?
Absolutely. The question is, how will the game be played by the judges in the state? That is, if what you're going to do is let lawyers form shop, which you traditionally don't do except for plaintiffs, and that's the way the system is set up by law, then you're going to wind up with an unprincipled process by which mandamus will be handled.
Well, let me interject here, because this isn't form shopping. We're not picking one county in one part of the state over another. All roads lead to here regardless of where you start and where you go through. It's going to come here one time or another anyway.
If the Court of Appeals does not contribute to the judicial process, then I would agree with that.
So what if they'd taken a five-hour pit stop at the Court of Appeals and come right on up here? We'd be here right now, maybe this afternoon instead of this morning.
Well, that presumes a couple of things. Presumes one, that the Court of Appeals wouldn't have given them relief.
which, with all humility towards the court, that's really not your decision to make until the Court of Appeals has had an opportunity to look at it.
Do you agree that this court would have jurisdiction to decide this by mandamus if they had gone to the Court of Appeals and the Court of Appeals had denied a stay?
No, I do not think that this court ever gets to look at this on a temporary injunction.
So it's either the Court of Appeals or that's the end of the line. Under any circumstances, on this temporary injunction.
At least they would be able to argue, if they had been denied the stay, that they had no other relief. They had no other adequate remedy in law. That is the key issue in mandamus. And
they should lose that argument, your contention is.
My contention is that you do not have jurisdiction over this matter because there is an adequate remedy in law set out very clearly in the Civil Practice and Remedy Code, Chapter 51, and in Rule 43 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure. If you choose not to invoke that kind of straightforward, easy-to-see relief, and instead try to jump to the Supreme Court, particularly when we are pushed up against the convention, not by anything that the plaintiffs have done below, but from what the party did. The party delayed from April 4th to sometime after May 21st and didn't give us a final answer until May 28th. And we were in court on June 1, and there was a weekend in between.
Any other questions?
I have a question quickly back on the state actor issue. You said if the party is not a state actor, then there's no free speech violation. Are you taking the position that we should not extend the First Amendment rights to private actions under the Texas Constitution?
No. The various tests related to state actors are tests that have been created. Most of the tests are the ones that have been created by the federal courts. Our courts are still struggling with the fact that the free speech clause of our Constitution is an affirmative right, whereas the First Amendment of the United States Constitution is a negatory right. That is, our Constitution gives affirmative rights related to the free speech. So our courts are still struggling with how broad the private party acting under color of state law, how broad that circle is. And that color of state law has traditionally been used in the cases and an argument as the state actor issue. That is, if a private actor is acting under color of state law, they are a state actor for purposes of federal decisions and in our own courts. And so the question is, how broad is that that circle of nominally private actors who operate under color of state law? This convention is set up clearly under color of state law because the law requires it. And the operation of the convention, when there are no provisions related to, and you can sell buttons there, you can sell candy, you can sell widgets, abortion rights groups can be there. The only people that can't be there are my clients.
Let me be sure I understand your position here. I hear you say that your view of this is affected greatly by the rules and practices of this party at this convention rather than political parties generally at conventions generally. Is that?
I think that is the point on our era. I mean, there are other issues, but that is what really drives this case home.
You don't think that a decision in this case necessarily binds the Democratic Party to give a booth to somebody that it doesn't want to in another setting? Or this party later?
Let me answer that in two ways. One, if you cited this case, this is so far out as far as the public purpose, the statutory basis of the party adopting the rule, that if this isn't state action, then certainly almost nothing that the parties do would ever be state action, or almost anyone else, unless they are, you know, the Attorney General sitting in his office signing. And that's just, you know, if we so narrow our state actor theories in our case law, then we will do what has happened in this state before, which is we will wind up giving those hard cases back to the federal courts, abdicating our role that the founders of this originally nation and then state gave to us to protect people's rights.
Let me interrupt. And the rule that they adopted, the rule that the Republican Party of Texas adopted that makes this state action, is that they adopted the Constitution and laws of the state of Texas.
I think if a totally private party,
yes or no question.
Yeah, yes or no. A yes or no?
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
And I think the reason for that is that the state law requires them to adopt such rules, and once they adopt the rule becomes a statute.
Any other questions?
Mr. Weissman, you said that the Republican Party has singled out your clients. Are you suggesting that it's the only entity that's been denied a booth and advertising at the convention?
I understand from the newspaper there's nothing in the record on this particularly. Well, I guess actually there is. Ms. Jackson testified that the Freedom Network had been denied. My understanding is they didn't get notice of that denial until sometime this week, which supports the contention that all of the reasons that mandamus have been claimed by the party are self-manufactured. That is, these issues could have been dealt with a long time ago, and the courts could have decided this in an orderly process. There would have been plenty of time to ask for a stay in the Court of Appeals. There would have been plenty of time then to consider whether, as an example...
Counsel, you're on our time now. These questions that can be yes or no ought to be confined to that. Any other questions? Would you, you mentioned that Wisconsin, California, and whatever state Kasajan comes from, are states where the parties got to determine their own membership. Could you give us a supplemental brief by 2 o'clock? It would help us with those.
Yes, Your Honor.
Internal party. Thank you. Court is ready to hear rebuttal argument.
Hey, please, Court, I want to address very quickly the issue of mandamus. Justice Gonzalez wrote the opinion in Sears. He stated in that opinion, the rule does not stand as an absolute bar to the filing of a petition in the Supreme Court without having first filed in the Court of Appeals. That's the rule of this court. It is also a rule of this court that if this issue is of statewide importance, this court can hear it in an original mandamus. Therefore, I believe the court does have jurisdiction.
Counsel, let's take Mr. Wiseman's last point. If you knew on the record support that you knew on April 4th what you were going to do, why should the courts of Texas turn handstands to decide this issue before tomorrow?
Your Honor, the record does not support that we knew on April the 4th what we were going to do. The record indicates that the application was received, the advertisement was received from the Log Cabin Republicans only a few days before the letter was sent out rejecting. That was the testimony clearly of Barbara Jackson. We did not even receive the print copy of their advertisement until late May, not in April. In April was when, earlier was when the mass mailing was sent out to everybody that had participated the year before.
What does the record show about when Ms. Jackson or the party learned about the purported contents of the booth exhibit?
Only a few days before Ms. Jackson's letter of rejection, and the letter of rejection was
May 21.
May 21, that's correct.
But you cashed the check on May 3rd.
That's correct. Just the day before, I think, is when the check was cashed on the booth. It was never cashed on the advertisement.
No, the check was cashed May 3rd.
May 3rd, okay. But it was only on May 21st that we received that advertisement. When we received the advertisement is when we understood what they intended to, the message they intended to give out at the convention. I would like to pick
can
up
you
on...
Say,
I've
got a question. Some of the U.S. Supreme Court decisions have been dealing with these parades and freedom of association, that sort of thing. My impression has been that a lot of those were after the fact. The parade had already been held or some event had occurred as it as the issue wound its way up through the appellate process and finally gets to the U.S. Supreme Court. Recognizing that your position is that this is really an important deal that's got to be decided today because of fear of what is going to happen tomorrow, but isn't the issue of such significance that really, as Mr. Wiseman says, this is something that ought to be brought up through the appellate process? And more to the point, if the legislature has spoken on the issue of temporary injunctions, which almost invariably deal with the immediacy, someone's being prohibited today from doing something, and the legislature says the appropriate way of handling that is an appeal only to the Court of Appeals. Aren't we in kind of a situation where when the legislature has spoken specifically about this issue and how it ought to be handled, that we just say, one, well, this is just so important, we'll do it by mandamus, regardless of what the legislature said about it. But on the flip side, if this really is that important of an issue and doesn't get mooted just because of tomorrow, but is an issue that's ongoing, is this not more an appropriate mechanism to see how the appellate process works its way out, see what the intermediate appellate court says on the appeal of the case, and see how the record develops?
Your Honor, this is different than a prohibitory injunction. We're not being prohibited from doing something. We are being ordered to affirmatively do something. We are being ordered to do something that will become moot on Saturday. So we're not maintaining the status quo. The order of the court that we are appealing is an order that commands Barbara Jackson to do certain things with respect to the convention. It is not a typical prohibitory injunction. I agree with Justice Baker that what the court should do is to stay the order, and then if the court wants to fully hear all the briefing and argument with a full record, the court can do that with respect to this important issue. But to us, the issue will become moot as of Saturday, and to go through the normal appellate process would not give us any relief. Under the Jones decision and under this court's adoption of the Jones decision, there are no damages that the Log Cabin Republican can make for a constitutional tort. Consequently, as the district court indicated, this is the final issue here. This is what they have requested. Now, if they had been denied their temporary injunction, then we would have had the capable of repetition but evading review doctrine that would have permitted the case to move on for future years. I'm addressing only the order of the court that has an affirmative duty on my client to do something tomorrow and to continue to do that on Thursday and on Saturday until the convention is over. And there is no way for us to get that issue up to the normal appellate process. It will be over by that time.
When must the inserts be inserted in the court?
Your Honor, in compliance with the court's order, we have received print copy from Mr. Wiseman's office, and they are being printed, and they will be distributed tomorrow beginning around noon.
And the booth could be set up tomorrow?
At any time, Your Honor. It could. For these reasons, we would urge the court to stay the lower court's order below and to give us relief from the injunction that has been entered.
Any other questions? Thank you, Judge. That concludes the argument in this cause, and the marshal will now please adjourn the court.